From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Over the past two decades, thousands of Catholic clergy worldwide have been accused as pedophiles. Last week, the Diocese of Atlanta and Savannah released the names of priests and seminarians under their respective authorities who've been credibly accused of sexually abusing minors dating back to the 1960s. In most states, the statute of limitations on these cases has meant many accused priests have not faced criminal charges. But last month, a legal loophole led to former Savannah Diocese priest Waylon Brown pleading guilty to 9 charges of criminal sexual conduct for abusing 2 boys in the 1970s and 80s. He was sentenced to 20 years in prison. Now, warning to listeners with children present and to others that we are going to be talking about that case with Chris Templeton. He's one of the 2 boys, so please do keep that in mind. As we welcome Chris from GPB in Savannah, Chris Templeton, thank you for joining us.
Yes, thank you, Virginia. Thank you for having me.
When Mirtha Donnestorg is with us, she's a researcher for CNN's The Row and reported this story out of Savannah. Mirtha, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Well, Chris, I'm going to start with you because the story is so devastating. How old were you when you first met Waylon Brown?
I was 13 in 1987 is when I met Waylon Brown, in August of 1987. I was getting ready to start my 8th grade year.
So are you comfortable telling us about how this abuse began for you?
Yes, ma'am. It's taken a lot of therapy and a lot of help from God for me to become comfortable, but our whole mission today for me is to spread out the message of hope for other victims who we know are still out there, to let them know that they're not alone, and they don't have to stay in that lonely, depressive state, that we are here and God's here, and that we're willing to help and do anything we can. I grew up in a neighborhood right across the street from St. James School, where I went to school, and probably had about 400 houses, I guess, in the neighborhood, and it was a bunch of kids. And back when I was in school, we didn't start school till after Labor Day, after September, first week in September. So it was in August, and we used to ride our bicycles over to the school across the street. And, play in the field, play baseball, basketball, football, whatever out in the field. And Waylon Brown had just been released from the treatment facility where they send the pedophile priest in Maryland. And he was just put back in St. James. And he used to come out there and watch us play ball. He got there and he was, I guess, put back in St. James in August of 1987. And a group of us were over there playing, and he started coming over there and throwing the football with us, and visiting with us and hanging out with us. That's how it all started.
Yeah. And you were just in eighth grade when you were abused, as you're estimating, 50 times in the span of 9 months. So yeah. Young. Were you able to tell anybody what was happening at that time?
No, actually, from the first time that he raped me, I've learned this now and figured this out through a lot of therapy, but I blocked it out completely. Mm-hmm. I blocked it out and went straight into what I like to call a survival mode. Pretty much a loose cannon for the next 30 years, trying to survive and make it through life without thinking about what was going on. From the first time it happened, I can realize that I had no control over it after that. It just happened whenever he wanted to and however he wanted to after that first time. But I completely blocked it out and did not even remember it. I'd struggled with depression and stuff most of my life and just didn't know why. But I had blocked it out and didn't remember it till November of 2014. When I was in a suicidal state and went to a mental hospital, and that's how I remembered everything.
You started going to therapy. You surfaced these memories. And I just want to thank you again for your courage in telling us about this. And Mirtha, Chris was not Waylon Brown's first victim. Also, Alan Ranta was one of the boys named. Can you tell us about his case?
Yeah, so Alan was 9 years old. His abuse started in 1978, the year after Waylon Brown was ordained a priest in the Diocese of Savannah. So Alan Ranta was 9 years old. He was a fifth grader at St. James, the same school where 9 years later Waylon Brown would meet Chris. And he formed a relationship, a friendship with this little nine-year-old boy. And he formed a trust between the two of them. And eventually he drove him over the Talmadge Bridge, took him to the Savannah National Wildlife Refuge in South Carolina, and he raped him there. Over the next few years, he would abuse him in multiple places in South Carolina as well as in Savannah, at the St. Anthony's Catholic Church in Hardeeville, South Carolina, also at an old train depot and this wildlife refuge. And like Chris, Alan also had this suppression of memories. It wasn't until he was in his mid-30s that he, as he called it, he had this memory recall where everything came back to him. And so it's a pattern of not only abuse, but of trauma that even though it happened 9 years apart, you can see in both Alan and in Chris.
Yeah, the confusion or the way that the memory is stored in the brain is not so predictable. And that's a twisted thing that you mentioned. He established trust and eventually really broke that trust in such a horrific way. And Chris, you knew Alan Ranta as a kid, right? Did you ever get in touch? And when did you realize you were both victims of Waylon's pattern of abuse?
Well, Alan was a good bit older than me. I had two older brothers, and he was between my two older brothers. I remember Alan in the neighborhood. Alan was, like I said, older, but Alan was a real good athlete. So, you know, the younger guys, we looked up at him, to him. He was a real good swimmer, big national swimmer. And, you know, I knew his family. My parents knew his family real well. But I had not seen Alan. St. James only goes through eighth grade. And then after eighth grade, the parochial school, you go to the high school. So when I was in the eighth grade, Alan, my brothers, all of them were gone. And Alan and I got back in touch after my civil case ended. And we were working on the criminal case. There was an organization called SNAP that had a meeting here in Savannah. And there was a little protest we did out in front of the Diocese of Savannah on Victory Drive. And Alan came in town for that. And I guess that was about 2 years ago. And that's when I was able to reconnect with Alan. And, you know, we've kept in touch since then, worked hard. You know, we just really, what we were looking for was that criminal guilty plea. And, you know, we both feel like that's what's going to help others come forward. You know, I don't use the word to give them courage to come forward, because any victim is full of courage, for them to have lived through that and survived through that, they're full of courage. Mm-hmm. But, you know, just giving them the willingness to come forward, and make them realize, you know, it's a lonely, scary place to be. Before you come forward. And it's not the easiest thing to talk about, and it's not the easiest thing to admit. And if you don't have the strong family support like I've had, it's hard, you know? And, you know, so Alan and I, so we've been able to keep in touch, and we really talked a lot during this last year, I don't know how much, but we talked the most in the last year after Waylon Brown was indicted, and we were leading up to the criminal case.
So that forming community, I think, is such an important part of the story, and the isolation that so many kids and survivors feel in general. Now, Mirtha, this is the interesting part here, that this happened after suing the Diocese of Savannah, in this civil case and then going for the criminal case. The legal loophole, when Chris and Alan came forward, the statute of limitations in Georgia had passed. So how did prosecutors manage to send Brown to jail?
So District Attorney Meg Heap in Chatham County, where Savannah is, she first got these allegations from Chris and Alan. And so she started looking into them, realized that she wouldn't be able to prosecute them because in the 70s and 80s, the statute of limitations on child sex abuse that had already passed. So she started reaching out for help from other law enforcement agencies. She reached out to the federal U.S. attorney for the Southern District of Georgia. And he was looking into it, but he couldn't bring charges. Again, statute of limitations. And so once she learned that the Father Brown had taken them across the Savannah River into Jasper County, she reached out to Solicitor Duffy Stone, not knowing if he would be able to bring charges, but just she needed to see if something could happen. And Solicitor Stone did some research into the laws and into the crimes and realized that he would be able to bring charges because there was no statute of limitations on child sex abuse.
And so now he's admitted, Waylon Brown admitted, or pleaded guilty, let's say. Where is Waylon Brown now?
So he is no longer a father. He was removed from the priesthood in 2004. He is 76, serving 20 years at the Kirkland Prison in Columbia, South Carolina.
Now, Chris mentioned that it was when Father Brown had come back from, I'm not sure if he was a father at that point, but when he came back from a rehabilitation stint for what he had done to Alan. So is that evidence that church leaders knew that he was a predator?
Yeah, so he was still a father. It wouldn't be until like almost 20 years later that he was removed from the priesthood. But he was sent to rehab, according to Solicitor Stone. He was sent to rehab officially for alcohol issues, but the church had received some allegations, abuse allegations, not related to Alan Ranta, but to different children. And so they sent him to the St. Luke Institute, which might sound familiar because the Boston Globe, in their original reporting, that was the place where priests were also sent.
The Spotlight team.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Right. So this is... Chris, we're gonna come up against a break in just a minute, but this is a big question. So many would-be criminal charges are stopped in their tracks by the statutes of limitation. So how long did it take to get Waylon Brown's guilty plea?
Well, it took a huge effort from, like she said, Meg Heap, you know, Jim Durham, the U.S. attorney, and Duffy Stone. I can't say enough about them, along with the help of Judge Mary Catherine Moss in Savannah, Georgia. They just were tremendous. They were awesome. I guess it took about 2 years. It took about a year to get him indicted, and then it took a year for the trial to come. So about 2 years. But, you know, it was from when we met with Meg Heap. Now, it took us another year, me and my family and I and my civil attorney. We did a lot of work, you know, from probably 2015 to 16, a good year ourselves trying to gather all the evidence to take to Meg Heap.
Right.
So a good 3 years, I would say.
What did it mean for you to hear Waylon Brown plead guilty for what he did to you and Alan?
I can't explain the emotion that came over me when I heard it. You know, it was just amazing. It just felt like slow motion when the judge said, you know, he asked for our permission, the judge did before the case, if he could use our names in the charges. And when he said, charge that you took Christopher Templeton over the state lines to St. Anthony's Mission Church and raped him behind the altar and in the altar boy room. And the judge said to Waylon Brown, now how do you plead to that charge? And he said, guilty, Your Honor, guilty. without a stop, without a pause. And the emotion and the tears just overwhelmed me because, you know, that was a victory for my 13-year-old self, who I think of often and feel like died at that time,
Chris,
that little child soul.
So. I am so moved by your story. I'm sure listeners are too, but we're going to put it on pause for just a minute while we take a break and come back with Chris Templeton, one of those who was vindicated, let's say, when Waylon Brown pleaded guilty to abusing children as a Catholic priest. Mirtha Donna-Storig is a researcher for CNN's The Row, and she reported this story. We'll be back in just a minute. This is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we're continuing our conversation with Chris Templeton and Mirtha Donna-Storig. A Catholic priest pleaded guilty to sexually abusing children in Savannah last month, and Chris is one of those. Mirtha Donna-Storig reported on Chris's story for CNN. So what about, Mirtha, the Savannah Diocese? Did they ever comment on Brown's conviction or take responsibility?
Yes. So they said that they agree that justice was served and they hoped that it would bring a measure of peace. But beyond that, they didn't respond to Brown having been sent to rehab before. They didn't respond to any of the other allegations.
Now, Chris, the Atlanta Archdiocese and Savannah just released a list of priests and other seminarians, quote, credibly accused of sexual abuse. This is something many of those survivors that I've read about, you've seen it on Twitter, et cetera, have said, you know, 15 priests for dating back to the 1960s doesn't sound like the spirit of transparency. I wonder what your thoughts are.
No, not at all. I mean, yeah, they were forced to do what they did. You know, they did it even after Atlanta. I'm talking of Savannah's right now. But, you know, it until they released the names of the bishops, the priests, you know, Father Keneally, Father McCarthy, the ones, Bishop Lessard, Bishop Bolin, who were involved in covering up and protecting this pedophile for 20 and 30 years, and the attorney for the attorney for the diocese, Joe Brennan, at the time. Until they list them, because I hold them, me being a victim myself, being a survivor, we hold the people that hid them, protected them, and covered it up just as responsible for us being raped as the priest that raped us. And until those people are exposed, until those people are removed from ministry, there is no moving forward. I mean, until you get rid of the poison, nothing's going to prosper. You know, so it didn't do anything for me. It didn't make me happy at all. I mean, you know, maybe we, you know, headbutted them enough, or maybe we've, you know, tugged on their pants leg enough, or maybe we've bothered them enough or been a big enough pest that they said, oh, we'll just go ahead and throw these 15 names out there. I mean, who got the names? The bishop released the names? I mean, did any authorities go through the paperwork with them to find out? I mean, have they released all their records? No. All they released was names of people who they wanted to list.
Well, Chris, we really have just 1 minute left, and I know that you're doing. No, please, I'm so, as you said, you are telling your story to embolden other people to not feel so alone and maybe tell their own. If you could just quickly, what's your message to other survivors out there who maybe haven't reckoned with this?
Yeah, get some help. Please call. My number is out there public. Call me anytime, day or night. Contact a therapist. Please get help. Call a lawyer. Do not do this alone, because the guilt and the shame will kill you. And I wanted to thank you guys, because if it wasn't for media and people like you that are willing to put us on the air and help us spread the message to other victims, it wouldn't get out. And thank you so much. Y'all mean so much. Mirtha, love you. Thank you so much.
Chris Templeton, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Mirtha Donna-Storg, researcher for CNN's The Row, reported the story out of Savannah. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And now we're heading into the kitchen for our occasional series, Main Ingredient. We invite chefs to talk about one essential Southern ingredient. Virginia Willis is Georgia-born, but spent years cooking in France and working on food TV with the likes of Natalie Dupree and Martha Stewart. She's author of 6 cookbooks, including titles like Bon Appetit, Y'all, and Lighten Up, Y'all. Her newest book, Secrets of the Southern Table, is a food lover's tour of the global South, and it challenges the stereotypes of a provincial Southern cook serving up pimento cheese or making cornbread in a cast iron skillet.
And actually, it's so funny because, you know, the whole thing has been this book is not just about fried chicken and biscuits. It's not about fried chicken and biscuits. And yet, everybody wants me to make biscuits. And I think I'm going to count up like how many biscuits I've actually made on book tour. And I'm really serious. I think it's approaching like 2000. I'm not kidding.
Virginia Willis defied all that and chose pears for her main ingredient. She made pear mostarda when we visited her home in Atlanta and served it with ham on biscuits. Slightly savory, scrumptious party biscuits, as she called them, made in a food processor. And we posted her recipe and directions online. It is super easy, even for the biscuit phobic.
People are terrified of biscuits. And so party biscuits are, I also like to call them biscuits with training wheels.
There are a lot of assumptions about Southern food. And then there's the thorny question of which culture owns it. It's a big conversation among food and cultural historians, and we did talk about that. But first, our main ingredient, the pear, and the basics, peeling.
Okay. So what are you doing? You're doing the stem?
Yeah, I'm doing some more towards the stem end. And then at the bottom, I'll go in a circular motion so it's more likely to keep its pear shape.
So why did you choose pear?
I chose pear. It's a traditional. Pear Mistarda is a traditional Italian preserve. I love pear. I've always loved pear because when I was growing up, my grandmother, they had a pear tree in the yard, and she would make a pear relish and a pear chow chow, which would be the southern, sort of the southern version of Mistarda.
Well, that's the thing, Virginia, you're known for, is expanding our definitions of what southern cuisine is. You know, you're taking traditional foods and putting your own stamp on them, or have you gathered these recipes by people who have innovated and expanded on old Southern cooking?
It's actually that the changes in Southern food and recipes that are in my book are a combination of both me meeting people and seeing what they're doing with traditional Southern ingredients and non-traditional ways, and then also my way of looking at traditional Southern ingredients and looking at them in non-traditional ways. I feel like that sometimes, especially because I have been writing traditional Southern cookbooks for like 10 years now, it can be a box. It's a wonderful box, but it can be a box. And so it's been exciting for me, especially with this book, to just to stretch a little bit and to show that not only do I cook, but that other people also eat food that's beyond fried chicken and biscuits. Right. So I'm just dicing this into roughly a half inch dice because it's going to cook down in the sugar and the vinegar. And if I cut it too small, we won't wind up with a relish. We'll wind up with a sauce. The pear tree that was in my grandparents' yard, I remember it just weighing, like being so full of fruit. My grandfather would pick them, and we'd make relish, and then he would also store them in the root cellar. You know, even in this recent age of bourbon and bacon and barbecue, the South is, in my opinion, an agrarian cuisine. It is primarily based in agriculture. And there are things coming off the vine and out of the garden and out of the ground and off a tree almost 12 months of the year. And that is not the case with much of the country. So eating seasonally and locally in the wintertime in Georgia might mean collard greens and sweet potatoes because they do grow here then. So I'm going to add half a cup of vinegar and about a tablespoon of mustard seed. And these are whole yellow mustard seed. And when they cook, they soften a little bit, but they still have some crunch. And then about a cup of sugar and a pinch of salt. And then this is kind of it. We're gonna let this cook and they'll cook down and soften. And at the end of cooking, we're going to spoon in and stir in some good French Dijon mustard, which really gives it some pop. This is also what I would call a refrigerator pickle. When I finish it, we'll just put it in a jar and it can be stored in the refrigerator for 6 to 8 weeks. Okay, I just want to stir it periodically, make sure it's not sticky. And I'm just going to turn it down just a tad so that it doesn't cook too fast.
About how you learned how to cook, because I know you studied in France, mm-hmm. but before that, was your grandmother?
Yeah, so this piece actually, that's the inside of my grandmother's cupboard. So if you imagine, like normally when I'm working, just cooking, I cook right here, or I chop and stuff right here. So if you were to imagine, like that would be the inside of this cupboard. So wherever she worked, she had these cupboards. And then so she just started taping her recipes up and then eventually just, you know, writing straight on the wood. So this is like
talisman slash, you know, shrine sort of thing. I know some of these are funny, right?
Have you ever tried the, this pecan pie sort of goes around a corner. And
chicken, salt, onion, celery, 350 at 1.5 hours. Like, my grandmother did not need a recipe for that. Like, well, I don't even understand why she wrote that down. I learned to cook with my mother and my grandmother. And, you know, when I was in junior high, I made cakes and decorated them and sold them to the neighborhood moms for their kids and stuff. So I've always loved to cook. When I started apprenticing for Natalie Dupree is when she took me out of my mom's kitchen and I really started to understand puff pastry and like things that weren't Southern, you know, like French cooking and the world of cooking. Like Mama made something that was like, you know, basically chicken and a velouté in a puff pastry, but that certainly wasn't what we called it, you know. It was like a patty shell.
Yeah.
But then I learned how to make the patty shell. Let me just take a peek at this real quick. So the moisture is mostly evaporated out of the pear. It's cooking a little fast, so I'm going to turn it down just a tad. But the pears are nice and soft, and all of the vinegar has cooked out. So I'm just going to turn it down to low and let the pears sort of simmer in their own juices.
One of the things that you write about in your book is all of the different forces and people and ethnicities. You know, people talk about the multicultural South of today, but you make the point that it has been like that for a long time. But obviously, black and white comes up a lot in our contemporary culture, and there's a question of ownership about food.
Well, ownership is a super tricky question. And as a white woman, I feel like I also have to be careful, right? I don't want to offend anyone. I don't want to try to not honor anyone. And I definitely, as a food writer and quasi-food historian, want to be able to celebrate the contributions that enslaved Africans gave Southern cooking. There is no doubt that for centuries, both the food that was prepared, the food that was grown, and the ingredients that were brought that came from Africa. What I am just want people to consider is I'm not defining what the ownership is. That's not what I'm trying to do, but I'm just trying to ask people to consider that it isn't one group or the other. It isn't one of the two that owns this. It just isn't. It's multiple cultures that create Southern food. So you can see that the pears still have their square shape, right? But they're almost translucent, mm-hmm. sort of this like pale golden translucent. And then so now what we'll do is spoon in a couple of tablespoons of Dijon mustard. And this is just going to really help the flavor pop. I love mustard.
That's a good dose of mustard.
Yeah. So I'll just stir that. If I were just going to make this and serve it straight away, you could put it in a bowl. I could also put this into a clean container, like a mason jar. And like I said, it'll store in the refrigerator for 6 to 8 weeks or as long as it lasts.
Having spent this time exploring so many different cultural mm-hmm. traditions, do you feel like you are going into the kitchen and making recipes for yourself, making food that is different than you would have 10 years ago?
Oh, sure. I'm definitely making food that's different than the food I would have made 10 years ago for multiple different reasons. One of the things that I feel like was able to translate into this most recent book is that my work has been predominantly about Southern food. That necessarily wasn't always what was in my life, right? And so what in this most recent book is just to explain that the South, we have the internet, right? We watch, we're educated people and, you know, watch different programs and listen to different programs and have exposure. And there are world-class ingredients both coming out of the South and then coming into the South, you know, and you think about like even here in Atlanta, like Beaufort Highway, it's like the UN. You can get anything you want there. And it's, yes, this is this major metropolitan area of Atlanta, but there are little pockets of it everywhere that we can get different things to cook and eat. Sorry. Mm-hmm.
So then what happens? What do we do with these beautiful?
So I want to make you a biscuit. How about that?
I couldn't possibly.
That's what you need to have in your life is a biscuit. I'm going to cut this with a serrated knife. I'll put a little bit of the mostarda on. And then I'm using an Iberico ham. All right, so there you are. There's your biscuit, ma'am. Well, that smile says it. There you go.
Oh, my God.
That smile says it.
The mostarda is really good. I thought when I saw how much mustard you put in there, mm-hmm. that it would have a super tang, but the pear sweetness, I think, would tone it down.
And it really is sour, salty, bitter, mm-hmm. sweet, right? So you've got a little bit of the sweetness from the pear and the sour from the mustard. And
a lot of beautiful things happening.
Yeah, yeah, that's it exactly. I think I might make myself one.
Mm-hmm. Chef and author Virginia Willis with the pear, her main ingredient. And of course, biscuits. Her newest book is called Secrets of the Southern Table, a food lover's tour of the global South. She's editor-at-large for Southern Living and writes Cooking with Virginia at southernkitchen.com.
Okay, you should eat your biscuit.
Any other biscuit
habits? Okay. So good.
Mm-hmm.
And we did post some photos and video of Virginia making those party biscuits. All of that is at gpbnews.org, or you can find them on our Facebook group, On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. In early October, Hurricane Michael slammed into Georgia. It was the most devastating hurricane to hit the state in recent memory. Farmers in southwest Georgia woke up the morning after the storm to a scene of utter devastation. Entire crops were wiped out in a night in some cases. Questions arose about what the next few months and years would look like for their businesses and their families. In response, Governor Nathan Deal called a special legislative session for later this month to set aside relief funds for hurricane damage. And today we're going to speak with two Georgia farmers to see how those efforts are going. Casey Cox is from Longleaf Ridge Farms in Mitchell County. She's a sixth-generation farmer. Casey, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me today.
Well, thanks for being here. Ricky Dollison is a fourth-generation grower from Dollison Farms in Worth County, Georgia. He's also executive director of the Ag First Community Co-op. And Ricky, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, I'm going to ask you both. Since Hurricane Michael hit, how have things been at your farm? You want to go first, Casey?
Sure, I will. We've certainly been taking one day at a time. At first, there was obviously the initial shock of just how different things would be. We knew that this was going to be a major change for us for not just this year, but for the long term. So we spent some time assessing, took a long time to clean up and get back to normal. We were without power for quite some time and then also had to get our internet and our phones back up. And so it's just been a long time returning to some semblance of normal. So now we're in the process of trying to move forward and start the cleanup and recovery process.
Okay, so your farm gets its name from the longleaf pine, and you farm pine trees. So
right.
What was the hurricane's impact on timber?
That has been honestly one of the most devastating impacts for us personally is on our timber. We have our farm is about over half of our farm is in timber and pine trees, and we were lucky because we still have trees standing, but that's really where we took the biggest hit. We also had some structural damage and some damage to our sweet corn, but the timber is where we took the biggest hit, unfortunately.
How about for you, Ricky, that next morning after the hurricane, how did things look at your farm?
That next morning was mentally, it was rough on me because I had to, the dirt roads that lead to my farm, oak trees was across the road, so I had to literally, you know, walk in. And then once I got in, I discovered that, you know, fences, trees, and broke down fences. I have swine, I have hogs, and my fences were down, so I had hogs everywhere. You just work till you get everything situated. Everything I had to do was temporary, just get my hogs back in the pen and get them situated. And then I just walked out into the cotton field and I just stood in the middle of the cotton field. And like I say, it was rough emotionally, just because you know, we have all of our finance tied up into those crops. So, you know, we took that day and just done the simple things we can do to get things back together. And really, we've been doing something just about every day since the storm.
Something to repair, something to clean up, that kind of thing?
Yeah, something to repair. You know, you got barns going to fail down, so you all time, you know, taking tin apart and taking rafters apart and just trying to get things situated, and hopefully one day, you know, you can, you know, rebuild or get a barn back, you know. It's just, and then some of those things have been there so long, you know, you don't fit stuff like that in your budget. So those things, we don't know when we'll get it back, you know, when we'll get it.
So you at Dollison Farms, you plant row crops like cotton and raise livestock, as you said. How many pigs did you lose?
Well, I'm steady losing. I'm giving penicillin shots, but I don't know what's going on. Initially, I had over 100 pigs, and then I lost like 30 in one night. My herd is dwindling, but as people say, this too shall pass. So once I get it, once I right the ship, you know, I'm taking care of the big sows and getting them shots and getting them medicine to whatever was in that storm, whatever it brought in. It mainly hit my piglets. My piglets wasn't about 35 days old.
Mm.
So that was my stock for my sausage brand.
Well, I'm so sorry to hear about that. And Casey, for you, like Ricky, like so many farmers, do you pretty much borrow money at the beginning of the season and then recoup it at the end? Is that the rhythm for your place?
Yes, ma'am, that is. And so that's why the storm coming at really the worst possible time. We were right in the middle of harvest, and it just really couldn't have come at a worse time. So we're definitely trying to figure out how to move forward as well. And, you know, we always look at our timber as sort of that rainy day insurance fund, and like a lot of other forest landowners in this area and people who are counting on that for their retirement or for their yearly income, we're really having to reevaluate what we're doing there, and it's going to be really tough for our community.
What are those conversations like with your neighbors about, you know, moving forward?
Initially, there was a lot of anxiety around what was happening. It's been really difficult to hear all of the stories. Every time I hear more stories from our neighbors and see what's happening in our community, it's really heartbreaking, because this didn't just affect farms and crops. This affected our entire community, our entire agriculture and economic infrastructure in Southwest Georgia. And this is really a major hub of our agricultural economy for the whole state, and where we produce so many crops like cotton and peanuts and pecans. And it was just drastically impacted by this storm. And it's devastating. And there's a sense of loss that we all feel. And we're all kind of grieving that and trying to move forward. But it's scary. There's a sense of fear and anxiety for the future and not really knowing how we're going to be able to move forward.
Rick, are you seeing that in your community as well?
We kind of like it just in limbo, because you borrow money to do the crops. And most time when you borrow, you're at that limit. So now when something like this happens, you have no resources, because you don't got it from all these limits. So you're just stuck. And people just, we just kind of in limbo. We just get, you know, have coffee and just sit and talk with each other, and just, you have those seconds of pauses there where people just looking out into the sky, and just, you know, we don't know what we're going to do. And see, you know, we have our educational systems here in Georgia. We have UGA, we have Fort Valley, and they teach us how to grow. You know, our yields are pretty good. And then when something like this happens, when you look for help, you know, sometimes the help comes, sometimes it don't. Then when it do come, it comes a year later. So
right.
It's just tough, because, you know, you can lose a farm and you know, in 12 months' time.
That's Ricky Dollison. He's a farmer down in Poland, Georgia, Worth County, and also with me, Casey Cox from Mitchell County. Both of them, like so many farmers in Southwest Georgia, suffered devastating losses from Hurricane
Michael, and Tropical Storm Michael. Governor Deal has called a special legislative session to talk about funding Hurricane Michael relief and cleanup efforts. His chief of staff said it could cost the state up to $100 million. How much, let me ask you, Casey, how much of that money do you anticipate being given to farmers?
That's a great question. I obviously can't speak to what our elected officials will do, but we certainly need their support at the state and federal level. There's not really any type of program or anything that exists right now that can address some of the issues that we've had. And agriculture is really the economic engine of our local community and of Georgia. And our entire infrastructure has been impacted. And so anything that can be done just to get us back going is critical to the health of our rural communities.
So what are you hoping for to come out of this special session?
Well, I hope that we will see some of those relief efforts, some of the programs to give families like ours and our neighbors the ability to move forward. No one ever wants to see these multi-generational family farms have to give up because of a completely unexpected natural disaster. So we need a lifeline. We need the ability to be able, we need some hope from whatever decision is made. We need something that gives us that safety net and that hope that we can continue to go forward.
Are people talking in your community about giving up?
I've definitely heard some farmers that are on the edge of that because it's in some of the growers in our community, if they've lost an entire orchard of pecan trees or there isn't even any cotton left on the stalk to pick, it would cost more money to run the machines to pick the cotton than to actually what they would yield on it. And I'm sure Ricky can attest to this as well. This was a bumper crop this year. It looked beautiful. Every time I drove through those fields, it was just incredible. And then people who, families that run cotton gins and peanut buying points and things like that, it's just, this is going to significantly impact our entire economy and our entire community.
Well, Ricky, you farm on 198 acres. How hard does a storm like this hit smaller farms in comparison to some of the bigger operations around the state?
Well, see, that's the question you just asked there. The smaller farms, I believe we suffer more because now, if and when the help do come down, a lot of small farmers down in this area, because our co-op members, we got co-op members in the Baker, Mitchell, Early County, Worth County, Daugherty County area, Tift County area. So you take small farmers, and the average age of these small farmers are in the early to mid-60s.
Hmm.
So to just tell us to go online, that's going to knock out a lot of seniors. They don't to go online and do what?
You mean to go online and apply for aid, that kind of thing?
Yeah. Because see, a lot of these people don't, if you live in the country, you may not have the internet service. But, you know, I'm fortunate I live here in the city, so I will be taking care of my co-op members. But I just know a lot of small farmers out in those small rural counties. It's going to be rough for them. And then, two, how long it takes, if and when an aid comes, how long? And then if it just be some common sense stuff where that it could, this help, if and when it comes, could get to the people that is needed and not just on and just tied up in red tape.
Right. This is a problem from what I understand and having spoken with other farmers. They're just now getting aid after Hurricane Irma. The legislative session is going to be held November 13th. There will be new lawmakers and federal lawmakers, local and federal. What do you need newly elected officials to deliver in terms of aid? Or maybe what is your message to them? Why don't we start with you, Casey?
My message for any of our elected officials and across the aisle, we need everyone at the table. We need new and innovative ideas for how we can be relieved. We need our local, state, and federal officials working together. This is definitely a time where we need our local, every elected official to come together and work together as a team to support our farmers in Southwest Georgia.
What do you think, Ricky? What's your message to this special legislative session?
We need a listening session with farmers. Farmers south of Macon, to the Florida line, from the Alabama line back to the Atlantic Ocean. We all different. You have blueberry, you have peach, you have swine, you have goat, you have everything. You have cow. You have small. You name it, we got it. But we all are growers. We all make our living from whatever we do, and we all need help at this time. So you need a listening session, and then be able to help the ones that, you know, be able to make something that fits. Not just throw something out there, and then it might help cows and goats, but it don't do nothing for hogs. So that's what I would like.
How about to the rest of Georgia? A lot of people may not be aware. You know, we got a lot of news about how hard things hit the panhandle, and some about Georgia, certainly about the cost, and there is this special session. But do you think people across the state know what you're going through?
Well, I would say that, first of all, I'm so appreciative that you've taken the time to talk with me and Ricky today about this issue, because that is a really important element. We're in a very rural part of Georgia. There are very few people, and it's the news has concentrated on the panhandle, and there was a significant loss there, but focusing on what we've lost is certainly not diminishing that either. And agriculture is the number one industry in the state of Georgia. I know some people outside of agriculture don't even realize that. And Southwest Georgia and the part of the path of this storm that was hit is so significant to this state. This will have local, state, national, even international implications, because we are producing, the growers down here that were impacted are producing food and fiber and fuel for not just Georgia, not just the United States, the entire world. And that was impacted by this storm. And that story is so important for people to understand, that it is critical that we receive help, because it's critical for the vitality of Georgia and for our entire state's economy, because we're such a huge part of it. Even though we're small in population, we are a major contributor to the economy.
Well, that was beautifully said. Anything to add there, Ricky?
Well, I do. I appreciate what you're doing, and I hope we can continue to keep it out there, because this storm has gotten lost in other worldly news, and things are happening, seem like, every week. And the week after the storm, maybe say the week after that, but now it seems to have dropped off because other things have started to happen around the world. And I'm thankful for you to keep it out in front of people so that they won't forget, because we know we're the southern part of the state, but when we can't produce, that can be felt around the world.
Ricky, thank you so much for speaking with us today. Really appreciate your time.
You're quite welcome.
Ricky Dollison from Dollison Farms, that's in Worth County. And Casey Cox, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. I appreciate y'all having us today.
Casey is from Longleaf Ridge Farms in Mitchell County. It's been in her family for 150 years. And that is all we have time for today. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, and The Raven Taylor. Alex Word is our engineer, Don Smith, our dean of grammar and script editor, and Amy Kiley, senior producer. You can join the conversation. How has the storm affected you? Are you still hearing about it and the plight of people in Southwest Georgia? We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can email us at onsecondthought@gpb.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for spending some time with us today on Second Thought.